journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, January 25th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
Silence is not an option.
A local controversy over the ancient remains of Chinese workers in LA, an in-depth look at an agreement over ceded lands in Hawaii, and a conversation with the Oscar-nominated director of Taxi to the Dark Side.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Some years ago, hundreds of bones of what are thought to be Chinese workers were discovered deep below Boyle Heights, alongside intricate ceramics, jade jewelry, and opium pipes. Some of the bones are more than a century old and offer a window into a dark chapter in Los Angeles history. Workers digging the subway tunnel for the Gold Line rail extension uncovered the cemetery, and the discovery thrilled Chinese-American historians because it was one of the few involving the earliest generations of Chinese immigrants who came to California to help build the railroads and perform other menial tasks, this according to the LA Times. Now a controversy over what to do with the bones has developed within the Chinese-American community and city officials. My guest is Professor Chor Suang Nin. She is a professor and chair at the Department of Anthropology and director of Asian and Asian American Studies at Cal State LA. She joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Nin.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, first, what was your reaction when you heard about the discovery of this ancient cemetery?
I was very excited. I thought it was a fantastic opportunity to learn about who the Chinese were at that time in LA's history.
And what is that history for those of our listeners who may not be aware or not be familiar? I mentioned a little bit about Chinese immigrants being brought in to work on the railroad, but can you give us a little bit more detail specifically in L.A.?
Well, the Chinese, after they finished the railroad in San Francisco, they came down to Southern California. So they were the railroad workers. They were also house servants. In fact, the first two who came to L.A. were two house servants, and then a few came down and they were working in the laundries. But the majority of them were working in the railroad. They built the railroad that connected San Francisco and Los Angeles. They worked in the San Fernando Tunnel, and they also worked on the railroad that connected Los Angeles and Orange County.
Hmm.
So. Shall I go on?
Yes.
And, of course, when the Chinese came here to work on the railroad, they also need to be fed. They need to eat. And many of the people who came with the railroad workers were also growing vegetables that were kind of part of their cuisine. So we started this thing called truck gardening, where Chinese would work in vegetable farms in the surrounding Los Angeles area. So, and the Chinese became vegetable peddlers. In fact, they monopolized the vegetable industry. They fed a growing city of Los Angeles.
Hmm. Were most of the workers men workers, male workers?
Most of the workers were men. In fact, there were so few women, and the number of women in the Los Angeles area was never more than 10%, 11%, 12%. And the women who came were mostly, they were enslaved. They were prostitutes and house servants.
Now, what was the immigration status of these workers? And in fact, refresh our memory of how they were even brought over to San Francisco.
The like all populations before California became a state, you know, most people could come. But by the 1860s and 70s, there were increasingly laws that were against the Chinese. Those that pertained to Los Angeles included the city council levying a fine on the a fee on the vegetable peddlers, and the same fee was not imposed on other people. And of course, then the larger law in the U.S., the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Law, targeted only the Chinese for exclusion.
That's right. In fact, that is a very important chapter in U.S. immigration history, the Chinese Exclusion Act. So, Professor Nin, what about the discovery now of these remains, this cemetery? What significance has it had in the Chinese American community? They were discovered about 3 years ago, and what's the conversation, if you will, been in the Chinese American community about this about the cemetery?
Well, many of the Chinese would like to see these artifacts and human remains be examined, because this is such a rare piece of history that we do not know about, and the remains and the artifacts provide a significant, fantastic opportunity for historians, for the community, and for scholars to see what was life like for this population. How did they live? What did they eat? What did they wear? And one of the very interesting piece of research done by a student of mine is a Chinese woman who was obviously a prostitute. She had opium pipes and ceramics and lots of buttons, but also a hat, which is a leather hat. So she had things that accompanied her burial that were both Chinese and also American. So it is these artifacts and the human remains really provide a glimpse into that chapter of the history of Los Angeles, in this case, the Chinese-American history.
So what to be done about them now? I understand there is a significant portion of the Chinese-American community that would rather the bones were reburied, and that basically the memories of these Chinese workers honored by simply reburying them without studying them.
Well, I think they're probably two views in the Chinese-American community, and one view supports the fact that these remains shouldn't be reburied. They should be understood by the future generations and by current generation of students and scholars, because we need to understand what is going on. So that is the dominant view, and this is represented by the Chinese Historical Society, Irving Lyons and Gilbert Holm, and also is represented by Councilman Mike Chen from South Pasadena, as well as Judy Chu, who is the Vice President of the Board of State Board of Equalization. So there is that view that the remains shouldn't be reburied right away. They should be understood, should be examined, should be and to provide us some kind of story about this population, this chapter of the Chinese American history, and also of course Los Angeles history. Others would like to be buried, would like to see this material buried, which I also understand, but it doesn't mean that both cannot be done, right?
So after their study, the bones could certainly, of course, be replaced and reburied.
Perhaps, yes, that can be done.
Now, there is, I understand, Cal State LA, is it, that has offered a laboratory to study the bones?
Yes, Cal State LA.
That's your university.
Yes, President Rosa and Provost Cardoza have provided support for with space with a forensic anthropology lab for the purpose of housing the remains and also housing the artifacts. President Rosa has also provided funding for this purpose. And Councilman Mike Tan is taking the lead in the community to raise funding to support the archival curation and study of these remains beyond what President Rosa will support. So there is a lot of support in the community, both academic and the Chinese American and community, to be sure that these remains are to remain above ground.
Is there going to be any attempt to determine the links between these remains and the people, you know, Chinese Americans who've been here for generations, whether there are any familial links, any ancestry here?
The MTA board did some work to try to find the relatives of the remains. I think nobody came forward. But what we do know is that, especially from Councilman Mike Chen, he said that his ancestors were buried in the cemetery, not the part, not the bones dug up by the MTA, but they were in the adjacent cemetery. So that people do know about certain of the bones, but we do not know who they are.
Hmm. So what now, Professor Nen, finally, what do you think is going to happen? How will a decision be made?
Well, it depends on what the MTA will do. I think it rests with them. I think for the first time, I think under Councilman Mike Chen's initiative, the subject is brought to the surface for discussion among politicians and also with Cal State LA. So now that's the opportunity for President Rosser to express his view that Cal State LA will be the institution that will provide the home for the remains and for the relics. I think perhaps the MTA will change their view about what to do, because in the past they didn't know what to do with the remains. But now there's a home. Perhaps the issue can be brought up for discussion again.
Mm. And of course, I'm assuming your desire as a professor at Cal State LA is for the remains to be studied before reburying them?
Yes, we have students who are into forensic anthropology, in archaeology, and also in social cultural anthropology. Let me add also that we have students who are in the ethnic studies program. We are also trying to understand the dynamics of relationship among the populations in Boyle Heights. These are students from the Chicano Studies, Pan-African Studies, Latin American Studies, and Asian and Asian American Studies. So the remains and how and the artifacts and how the whole collection is handled right now are topics for understanding by many students from various departments and disciplines. It's not just within the anthropology department.
Well, Professor Chor Swang Nen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Chor Swang Nen is a professor and chair at the Department of Anthropology and the director of Asian and Asian American Studies at Cal State LA. We've been talking about the ongoing controversy regarding the remains of what are thought to be Chinese workers that were discovered 3 years ago under Boyle Heights. You are listening to Uprising. It's a very rainy day, and you are probably listening to us online today since we are unfortunately off the air. So we do encourage our online listeners, if you know others who are regular KPFK listeners, you might want to call them or email them, let them know that they can listen to us online. We are broadcasting as we normally do. We may rebroadcast some of our segments from today on Monday as well. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at a new documentary that was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. It's called Taxi to the Dark Side. The filmmaker will be joining us in studio, and we'll hear this week's Black Agenda report. After this radical day in history, we'll take a look at an agreement over ceded lands in Hawaii. We'll dissect that agreement. Stay tuned.
Hi, Maggie LaPique. When you have a chance, would you be kind enough to call me and tell me what a hoopty is? That's a great ad, but I didn't understand the word hoopty. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. So many of you out there have been calling and saying, sure, I'll donate my hoopty to KPFK, but what's a hoopty? Well, in line with KPFK's mission statement, and I paraphrase, to engage in activity that shall contribute to a lasting understanding between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, Maggie and I will now translate from the African-American into the Anglo. A hoopty is a junker.
A clunker.
A jalopy.
Chitty chitty bang bang.
A lemon.
A bucket of bowls.
A heap.
A rattle trap.
A bucket.
A gas guzzler.
A pinto.
A gremlin.
So look out the window at your driveway. Go ahead, look. If any of the above mentioned are in your driveway, consider donating that hoopty to KPFK.
You can do that by calling 877-573-5288, and we'll take care of the details.
You can also visit kpfk.org and click on the purple Donate Your Vehicle button.
People! People, the time has come.
This is your radio reporter, Arturo Contreras,
On this day, January 25th in 1942, during World War II, Thailand declared war on both Britain and the United States. And since the war broke out, the Japanese military had been pressuring Thailand to give Japanese troops uninhibited access to their land. And this would enable Japan to easily move through and attack certain British military camps. In accordance and cooperation with Japan's wishes, Thailand temporarily declared war on the U.S. and the U.K. As the Thai government became increasingly wary of Japanese occupation, America spotted a perfect opportunity to intervene, and the U.S. offered to organize an underground movement to get rid of the Japanese. What a familiar scenario. I wonder if this was a benevolent act of American exceptionalism, or if it was a strategic move based solely on self-interest. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. Last week, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the state government of Hawaii announced a multi-million dollar compensation deal on ceded lands. More than 200 acres of territory once belonging to the Kingdom of Hawaii are set to be transferred from the state government to the state agency of the OHA. Still needing approval from the legislature, the deal would give the Office of Hawaiian Affairs a one-time cash payment of $13 million, in addition to commercial and industrial properties valued at $187 million. The current $15.1 million in annual revenues collected by the agency would continue unabated. Hawaii Governor Linda Lingle and OHA Chairwoman Haunani Apollonia jointly described the deal as, quote, reasonable, fair, and long overdue. However, some lawmakers feel that the deal will not be well received among the majority of indigenous Hawaiian communities. On the other hand, critics from the right fear that a precedent has been established for future lawsuits over Hawaiian lands. The settlement failed in addressing overthrow claims. In 1893, the United States overthrew the legal and internationally recognized Kingdom of Hawaii and imposed a puppet regime. It later annexed the territory from. My guest is Kahualani Kawanui. She is an associate professor at Wesleyan University, specializing in the contemporary Hawaiian sovereignty movement. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Kawanui.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. Let's talk about the historical context here first. For our listeners in Southern California who may not be familiar with the context of these ceded lands and of this agreement, why it's significant. I mentioned a little bit about the U.S. overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii, but give us a little bit more detail.
Yes, thank you. We have an elder activist back home in the Hawaiian Islands named Dr. Kekuni Blaisdell, who always reminds us that whenever we hear the term ceded lands, we really need to rephrase it as stolen lands. These are the kingdom, crown, and government lands that belong to the sovereign monarch. And after a bandit overthrew our kingdom with the support of 13 white men in 1893, the provisional government set up shop and established itself in 1894 as the Republic of Hawaii. It's that republic that then cedes those stolen lands to the United States federal government in 1898. So these are lands that are unadjudicated. Native Hawaiians and others who descend from citizens of the kingdom still have an unadjudicated claim to these lands. They total 1.8 million acres, which is roughly two-thirds of the Hawaiian Islands. Now, in 1959, when the Hawaii Admission Act was passed by the U.S. Congress, there was a public land trust that was created, and that's in Section 5 of the Admissions Act. This is part of what's at issue between the sovereignty groups that want to see the Hawaii claim dealt with under international law instead of the current proposal before the U.S. Senate known as the Akaka Bill, which would federally recognize a Native Hawaiian governing entity through U.S. domestic law, which I see as a process of containing the Hawaiian sovereignty claim. But when you have this public land trust delineated in the Hawaii State Admissions Act of 1959, what you have in there, and this is also reproduced in the Hawaii State Constitution, you have a stipulation in that section of the act that details purposes for the so-called public land trust, right, formerly the Crown and Government Lands of the Kingdom. And one of those purposes, one of the five purposes listed in the Admissions Act, is that the revenues derived from those lands are to be used, quote, for the betterment of the conditions of Native Hawaiians.
And so that's the money that goes to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs?
Well, yeah, it never actually did, and that's part of the problem even under state law. Mm-hmm. So even if we look at just for a moment in the actual framework of U.S. law and the state law, the revenues never did actually get transferred. If you look between 1959 and 1978 when the Office of Hawaiian Affairs was created, the territory never actually did improve the betterment of the conditions of Native Hawaiians as per law. In 1978, the state held a constitutional convention that created the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to look out for those Hawaiian interests and revenues. What's interesting is you look at the media coverage in terms of this settlement, and they say the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the state created a settlement. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is a state agency. It's a corporate body existing under the constitutional laws of the state of Hawaii, and it also does not represent the Hawaiian people. Anybody who is a registered voter in Hawaii, regardless of ancestry or indigeneity or racial background, is entitled to vote for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs trustees. So the media is misconstruing this as a independent body that represents the Hawaiian people when it's actually a state corporation. And when they say the Office of Hawaiian Affairs struck a settlement with the state, to be more specific, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs struck a settlement with the executive branch of the government of the state, and that is Governor Lonnie Lingle, who's a Republican. And now it needs to go to the legislative branch, right? Because you had the Hawaii State Supreme Court saying that this had to be hammered out between the executive and the legislative.
So basically, this is a decision between, you know, within the state government itself, one part of the state government making an agreement with another part of the same entity in a way.
Yes, and that's right. In the past, we had a two-term governor, Benjamin Cayetano, who refused to ever actually transfer revenues to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. And the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, as I said, was created to hold title and all real personal property conveyed to it, and that's why it's a corporation. It's allowed to develop a portfolio of those revenues that are derived from those lands. So, for example, all of the major airports in Hawaii sit on those lands. So the revenues generated from the airport, part of those are supposed to go under state law. Some of those revenues are supposed to go to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Cayetano refused to deal with that. So this settlement that we're seeing, just to put it in perspective, it's a very specific settlement. It resolves claims and disputes relating to that portion of income and proceeds from the lands of the so-called public trust, which, again, I want to problematize. That is, those are stolen lands that the U.S. government then, you know, gave back to the state of Hawaii when Hawaii was admitted into the Union, which also was a violation of international law. However, if we're looking in the state framework, this is just this settlement is to resolve the claims and disputes over those revenues for three decades. So it completes, and it's a complete and final settlement to deal with three decades of state violation of the provisions of the Public Land Trust as described in the Admissions Act.
And the land we're talking about here is only 200 acres.
Pardon me?
It's only 200 acres?
It's 200,000 acres.
200,000 acres.
Yes. You know, it's a pittance of amount of money. It's, you know, roughly 200,000 acres of unspecified amount, actually, of land, and $15.1 million annually on top of the immediate cash settlement. But this is back rent. This is dealing with 1978 to 2008 to deal with revenues that were never transferred. Mm-hmm. So that's all it is back rent. It doesn't settle the Hawaiian claim to those lands. We are still entitled to those lands themselves, 1.8 million acres. That's unadjudicated, which actually gets to the broader political issue that's being missed, I think, in the coverage of this settlement.
Mm-hmm.
The Office of Hawaiian Affairs, on the one hand, if you looked at it just as a simple, narrow revenue issue and thought, okay, good, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is finally making, you know, trying to get the governor to cough up what should have happened all along. But there's something much bigger and much more insidious happening, and that is that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is trying to position itself as the next Native Hawaiian governing entity under this federal legislation that I mentioned earlier. It's known as the Akaka Bill, which the official name of the legislation is the Native Hawaiian Reorganization Act of 2007. Hmm. And if it passes out of the Senate, that's what it will create, is a domestic dependent entity along the lines of a tribal government under U.S. domestic law. And the Office of Hawaiian Affairs has actually been using Hawaiian trust money from some revenues to actually perpetuate a propaganda campaign for this federal legislation. This is a federally driven bill. It has the backing of a Republican governor, which is, number one, a huge red flag. If you look, I live in New England. The state government here does not want any more tribes to become federally recognized because, by definition, federal recognition for an indigenous governing entity is at odds with the state, just by definition, structurally.
Right.
So here in this case in Hawaii, you have a Republican administration pushing the Akaka bill, and you have the Office of Hawaiian Affairs using Hawaiian trust monies to fund a campaign in support of the Akaka bill, along with the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, all these different agencies that look Hawaiian on the face of it because there's Hawaiians running it, but they're accountable to the state. Now, if the state supports federal recognition for Hawaiians, we have to ask, what are they going to get out of it? Why is it that every other state in the union is opposed to federal recognition for tribes and indigenous peoples within their area, their state boundaries? That's because it's a threat. The Akaka bill is not a threat to the state, and that's why Hawaiians who want actual sovereignty and self-determination are opposed to the Akaka bill, including myself.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Kahualani Kawanui. She is an associate professor at Wesleyan University, specializing in the contemporary Hawaiian sovereignty movement. Finally, Professor Kawanui, what is the state of the Hawaiian sovereignty movement? Clearly, as you mentioned, this agreement is not something that is necessarily viewed as a positive step in the right direction. But what is the current status of the movement? How far along are they in struggling for their sovereignty?
Well, I see three really prominent divisions in terms of the political scenario. You've got the Hawaiians and others who are supportive of federal recognition and support the Akaka bill. They want to contain Hawaiian claims. They're going to settle. They want that compromise. They don't want to wait and see if we can have our case adjudicated under international law. Then you have Hawaiian independence activists who want the U.S. to deoccupy Hawaii. And some talk about it as deoccupation, and some talk about it as decolonization. And that is that under international law, we have a watertight case to full independence, given that the Hawaiian Kingdom was an internationally recognized nation state throughout the 19th century and recognized around the globe. Now, you have something else going on that's quite ugly, and that is you have a backlash amongst neoconservatives in Hawaii who also oppose the Akaka bill, but on very different grounds. They are not supportive of Hawaiian sovereignty. They are using the anti-affirmative action posing as civil rights to try and stem the tide of any assertion of Hawaiian claims. They reduce Hawaiian sovereignty claims to racial claims. And these are settler colonial groups like Aloha for All, Grassroots Institute of Hawaii. They're attached to their own media. They have a newspaper called Hawaii Reporter that actually just put out a very racist cartoon that won Funniest Cartoon of the Week that was really targeting Hawaiians, and that was thinly veiled racism masquerading as satire. So you've got a really complicated situation in the sense that you have a backlash against the bill from the right. You have the state and federally driven bill, which is problematic for Hawaiian sovereignty claims, and then you have radicals who see the case of Hawaii is much bigger and beyond the U.S., and that's why, to them, this settlement is a farce in many ways, because you're still doesn't dislodge the misperception and the illegality of these being a public trust land territory in the first place. These are stolen lands. These are lands that are unadjudicated, and the U.S. government acknowledged that in the 1993 apology resolution, where both houses of Congress, and it was signed into law by President William Clinton, they actually apologized to the Hawaiian people for the overthrow, and there is a finding within that legislation that says the Hawaiian people never directly relinquished their sovereignty claims over their national lands, either through plebiscite, referendum, or their monarchy. That's the 1.8 million acres that we're talking about.
Right. Well, Professor Kawanui, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We'd love to talk to you again in the future about more stories along these lines. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Good day.
Thank you. Professor Kahualani Kawanui is an associate professor at Wesleyan University, specializing in the contemporary Hawaiian sovereignty movement. We've been dissecting the current land agreement on so-called ceded lands that is being debated in the Hawaiian legislature. You are listening to Uprising, and after this week's Black Agenda report, we'll find out about a new documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is on the subprime lending debacle.
The core institutions of American capitalism have condemned Black and Brown America to further centuries of wealth disparity. Now standing at about 10 to 1, the wealth gap between African-American and white median households cannot but grow bigger in the wake of the subprime lending catastrophe. The Boston-based United for a Fair Economy recently released a report detailing the carnage wreaked on people of color by predatory lenders, and it is mind-boggling. The report, titled Foreclosed, State of the Dream 2008, shows definitively that banks and other lending institutions trapped Blacks and Latinos in predatory lending schemes as a matter of policy. Even a surface check of the demographics shows, the report says, that in city after city, a solid majority of subprime loan recipients were people of color. The very scope of the crime proves that the lending crisis is not the product of Black culture, but the result of calculated policies nearly uniformly carried out by virtually all of the nation's mortgage lending institutions. This is institutional racism writ large and indisputable. The moneylenders have already sucked the value out of whole communities, urban and suburban. The wealth loss is staggering. People of color have collectively lost between $164 billion to $213 billion over the past 8 years, with Latinos losing slightly more than African Americans. For the average American, wealth is passed on through the value of homes. That dream, as the report concludes, has been largely foreclosed. Before the crisis hit, it was estimated that it would take 594 years, more than half a millennium, for Blacks to catch up with whites in household wealth. Now, in the aftermath of the home mortgage massacre, it could take 10 times as long, more than 5,000 years, before Blacks achieve homeowner parity with whites. Looking backward, that stretches from now to when the Great Pyramids were built. If Black wealth creation through home owning is central to the drive for equality, then the private sector cannot be allowed free rein. They have already proven themselves criminally culpable in the death of dreams. And the crisis is by no means over. The rot extends to the non-mortgage practices of global financial institutions that bundle worthless paper and trade it like real money. So deeply corrupt are the megabanks, brokerage houses, and finance capitalists of all kinds, the entire planetary house of cards is in danger of collapse. Domestically, cities are already feeling the crunch of diminishing home property taxes, having long given away much of their tax base to attract many of the same corporations that created the current crisis. Boarded-up houses destroy property values in the surrounding neighborhood, but there are at present no reliable private mechanisms to reverse the devastation. The banks aren't even taking each other's paper, knowing it is as worthless as their own. Forget the sales sloganeering that owning a home is the American dream. Affordable housing is what the people need, whether rental or family-owned, many millions of new units. The private sector cannot, will not provide affordable housing, since it is more concerned with creating artificially high sales values than with meeting the public's crying needs. Now that the bubble has burst, it should never be allowed to be reinflated. There is only one alternative, and that is massive public spending on housing that fits the actual needs and budgets of the citizens. That's the very least one can demand from one's government. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And for more information, visit www.blackagendareport.com.
On December 5, 2002, Dilawar, the taxi driver, was brought to Bagram. He was designated a PUC, person under control, number 421.
He was something to do with a trigger man for a rocket attack, and that's about all I know.
5 days after his arrival, he was dead.
Soon after the American defeat of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, a young Afghan taxi driver named Dilawar was arrested by pro-U.S. Afghan militias and imprisoned at Bagram Air Base. In the 5 days before he died, he was subjected to cruel, unusual, and degrading punishment and became perhaps the first victim of torture in the U.S.'s war on terror. Alex Gibney, award-winning director of Enron, the smartest guys in the room, now brings us a new documentary called Taxi to the Dark Side, of which we just heard a clip. It focuses on the protocol of torture and cruel interrogation techniques used by the U.S. military in Bagram, Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, Iraq, and Guantanamo, Cuba. Taxi to the Dark Side was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. It opens today at the Landmark New Art and Pasadena Playhouse 7 Theaters. Alex Gibney joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, first, congratulations on the nomination.
Oh, thank you.
The documentary is, I think, in watching it, extremely essential and extremely disturbing. You feature in the documentary all of the photographs that we saw coming out of Abu Ghraib and more. They were uncensored. There were videos, too. Where did you get all of this information, first of all?
Some of it comes from various sources, sometimes from soldiers, sometimes from lawyers, sometimes from other sources. And in addition to the Abu Ghraib photos and cell phone camera footage, we've also obtained some of the first footage ever from the Bagram prison.
And Bagram was where this Afghan man, Dilawar, was killed. And it was admitted by the U.S. Army that he was basically died as a result of homicide. Why did you choose the story of this man to tell the torture, tell us the story of the U.S.'s torture techniques?
Well, there were a number of reasons. First of all, he was a pure innocent. I mean, this was a kid, really. I mean, I think he was 23 years old when he was killed. He'd never spent a night away from home. He left behind a wife and a very young daughter. But also, a number of things disturbed me about it. And the article that I originally saw that led me to Dilawar was written by Tim Golden of the New York Times. And in the last paragraph of the article, one of the people he interviewed remarked that after day three of a five-day interrogation, they concluded that he was completely innocent. But they tortured him for another 2 days. So it was the momentum of torture, I think, that was interesting to me. And the last thing was that the people who interrogated Dilawar were then sent from a Bagram to Abu Ghraib. So it showed the connection that this is not a bad apple story. And also the three people who rode in his taxi were sent to Guantanamo for no reason, presumably, other than to cover up the fact that military personnel had killed an innocent man in Bagram. So by looking at the Dilawar case, you could see how it all fit together, that it was not an isolated incident. Indeed, it was an act of policy by the Bush administration.
Now, you talked to the soldiers who were involved. In particular, Willie Brand was one of them. What was their sense of what they did and what happened?
Well, it was peculiar, and I can tell you that when I initially was able to interview them, I did not look at them sympathetically at all. These were people who had actually, collectively killed a man in their custody, somebody who, had no weapons. It was shackled. But at the same time, they were clearly haunted by what they had done, and they had felt that they were either encouraged or explicitly ordered to do what they had done, and they didn't understand why they were being punished and why their superior officers weren't even being investigated, much less indicted. And also, they told me that routinely very, very, very high-ranking people would come through the Bagram prison and would see prisoners shackled overhead, beaten and other things, hooded. These things were not part of traditional American military procedure, but it was clearly condoned by very high-ranking officials. So I think they felt scapegoated.
And New York Times writer Carlotta Gall, in the film, she shows her interview of a high-ranking official who says that he was not aware that there were ever shackles used from the ceiling and that sort of thing.
And that's clearly just false. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a number of lies that came out of Bagram. I mean, you mentioned that that the army said that Dilawar's death was a homicide. Yes, it did, but it took a long time for that to come out. Initially, the army said he died of natural causes. Now it was Carlotta Gall and her rather heroic effort to go up and see this Afghan family. She discovered that along with the body, they had a death certificate. And it was on that death certificate that that an impressive army coroner had said that the cause of death was homicide. And because of Carlotta's investigation, the Dilawar case began to be opened up.
I remember that very, very detailed series of articles in the New York Times that came out about not only Dilawar, but another Afghan man, Habibullah, describing in excruciating detail what was done to these men. Let's hear an excerpt from the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, which is done by my guest filmmaker Alex Gibney. Again, the film was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary, and this clip also focuses on the Afghan man, Dilawar, who was killed in Bagram.
Throughout the investigation and even in the trials, a lot of the guards and interrogators described Dilawar as a very combative detainee, as a tough character, and that's just never been reconciled with all the other evidence that there was about this guy. He weighed 122 pounds when he died.
The men who had been passengers in Dilawar's taxi told us later that he had just been absolutely terrified at Bagram, that they heard him through the walls of the isolation cells screaming for his mother and father.
He'd been in a very uncomfortable position, muttering things, sometimes praying, sometimes asking for help, or seemingly asking for help. Because I couldn't understand his language.
A number of witnesses remember the night before Dilawar died.
But just that one night, he got kicked in the leg, maybe like 10 times.
Some of the soldiers said they started using the knee strikes essentially to shut him up because he was yelling and screaming.
The damage that was done from multiple strikes, and a lot of that could have been avoided had you known the person before you had fought with them and used that exact technique.
When they eventually came to take him to an isolation cell, I believe his body had become almost limp. One of the reasons why they began punching him was that they felt that he was putting it on. He was in the airlock, standing there with a hood over his head. He had his hands tied above his head, and he was moaning.
That's the voice of Muazzam Beg, one of the detainees actually at Guantanamo, describing Dilawar and what was done to him, the Afghan man who was perhaps the first victim of torture in the U.S.'s war on terror. That was an excerpt from the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. It opens today at the Landmark New Art in Pasadena Playhouse 7 Theaters. Alex Gibney, the filmmaker, joins me in studio. And so this story of this one man really opens up the whole can of worms about how these methods of torture have become so commonplace now in the U.S. Army, U.S. military in general. Can you talk about the role of Dick Cheney in particular and Rumsfeld and the fact that there really were no written guidelines, that a lot of these rank-and-file soldiers had to sort of make it up as they went along?
Well, I think what happened, the film is called Taxi to the Dark Side, and Dark Side refers to a quote from Vice President Dick Cheney about a week after 9/11, where he told Tim Russert on Meet the Press, "We're now going to have to go over to the dark side." And he meant a lot of things by that. In particular, he meant actually explicit new guidelines for the CIA that permitted the CIA to do things like waterboarding and others. But also, it was a conscious attempt within, through Dick Cheney's office and also through the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice, to try to undo some of the rules and regulations that had formerly been guidelines for military personnel in the field. At the same time they removed those guidelines, they also exerted tremendous pressure on soldiers to get information. So that was a kind of fog of ambiguity, along with this pressure that caused soldiers to, essentially leave any bonds of morality behind. It's also important, though, to note that Donald Rumsfeld had given explicit authorization for extreme and cruel techniques to be used on certain detainees at Guantanamo. Those were written orders. Together, those techniques were certainly tantamount to torture. But what happened was, and the way this stuff spreads like a virus that mutates and migrates is, you know, when soldiers in Bagram heard that soldiers in Guantanamo had permission to do some of these things, explicit permission from Rumsfeld, who was, you know, looking in on the interrogation almost on a daily basis, they then started to use them themselves in a kind of a peculiar can-do fashion. It was as if the civilian administration was giving a wink and a nod to the entire, to every aspect of the military and saying, go for it. The gloves are off. That was an expression that was often used many, many, many times. Or as some of the soldiers at Bagram were told by their superior officers, it's time to take these detainees out of their comfort zone.
Tell us what was done to Muhammad al-Qahtani. And first, remind our listeners who he was. He seems to have suffered perhaps the worst, at least documented, case of torture.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's the worst. I mean, after all, Dilawar died, and we know about Dilawar, and there were a number of other detainees who were actually killed in detention and classified as homicides by the military. But Muhammad al-Qahtani is an interesting case. He was, we think, the 20th hijacker. And he arrived in Guantanamo without us really knowing who he was. It was discovered that he may have been the 20th hijacker while he was at Guantanamo. And Donald Rumsfeld approved a special interrogation plan for Qahtani, and then later one other person named Slahi. And these interrogation procedures are cataloged in a 65-page interrogation log, which we obtained. And these are extremely extreme procedures, but also increasingly bizarre procedures. He was stripped at times. He was subjected to extreme extremes of heat and cold. At one point, he was forcibly hydrated. He was forced to urinate in his pants. He had to be taken to the hospital because his heart rate had slowed so extremely. So this is a guy who was unquestionably tortured by intent and by order.
Now, the sleep deprivation went on for, what, 50 days?
I'm not remembering now exactly, but it was over a month. Mm. And initially, the rule was he would get 4 hours of sleep per night. But you saw after a week or so that it wasn't really 4 hours straight. Occasionally, they would let him sleep for 5 or 10 minutes and then resume the interrogation. They were pushing the envelope in every extreme way possible. And that's one thing that happens, I think, that most people don't realize. The reason that the military has rules and regulations about interrogations is that in the field, you know, there's a thing that the military knows about. It's called force drift. And if you push somebody and they're not giving you information, then you push them further and further and further and further until you've completely left the building. There's a kind of incremental process that goes on in which everybody or almost anybody can go over to the dark side, as Dick Cheney would have said, and push things further and further and further. I think we're capable of it. Many of us are. And that's why we have rules and regulations, because we don't want our armed forces to become a mob, in effect, or a lynch mob, more particularly.
My guest is Alex Gibney. Taxi to the Dark Side is the name of his film that he's directed, and it's opening today at the Landmark New Art and Pasadena Playhouse 7 Theaters. It was just nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. The film, as I mentioned earlier, is extremely disturbing to watch, but I think extremely essential as well. I think laying bare what the American government itself is capable of. I mean, you said that most of us are capable of these sorts of torture methods, but our government essentially is to be held responsible ultimately. Can you talk about the fact that the lower level soldiers have often been indicted, have often been prosecuted for these, for the deaths and torture of many of these men? But what about those higher ups? And what did your film reveal about the links, if you will, all the way up to the top?
I think if you watch my film, there's just no question that torture, as practiced in the war on terror, was an explicit policy by the Bush administration. There's just no question about it. Now, they called it by different terms. They tried to redefine it. They tried to define it out of existence. And so President Bush can say over and over again, we do not torture. And I suppose if you have a definition of torture that doesn't exclude anything, then I suppose he's right. That's the kind of thing that they were doing. But there's no question, if you watch the film, that you see that this was a clear policy. They wanted to go over to the dark side. They wanted to take the gloves off. I think they did so, and the question of why haunts the film. I think they did so because, in part, they were ignorant and arrogant at the same time. And I think, in a peculiar way, they were weak. They didn't know what else to do. If you study torture as an interrogation technique, you learn that it does not provide reliable information. That's very often why the military doesn't use it. That's why the FBI doesn't use it. And indeed, one of the things you discover in the film is that the interrogation of a man named Ibn Sheikh al-Libi resulted in torture, and the information obtained from that torture was the thing that actually helped to lead us into the war in Iraq. Colin Powell used that evidence in his famous address in the UN. So torture is extremely dangerous and ultimately leads to the corruption of the rule of law. But there's no question, if you see the film, that this was not an accident. This was a policy.
Finally, Alex Gibney, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the process of making this film? I mean, it has a haunting quality to it that I think you very effectively employ to depict the nature of the subject. How long did it take you to make this film? What were some of the challenges involved?
It took about a year and a half to make. I think it's fair to say that when we started the film, no one wanted to talk to us, and we didn't have any images to show. So that was somewhat daunting. It was a similar problem with Enron. But we pushed, and over time we got the images. We got people to talk to us, both inside the administration, also soldiers who had committed brutal acts, and also some heroes who had tried to rudder against this. But I think the most difficult thing in making the film was actually being subjected to those images day after day after day. That has a brutalizing effect on you. And indeed, you know, the images we included in the film, we purposefully censored some of the more extreme images, not censored them, but realized there are some images that were so extreme, so grotesque, that most people couldn't even handle them. It was only over time that we were able to. We'd become desensitized. But I think it had a kind of corrosive effect on our own psyche that I think it took us a while to understand.
I have to concur. It was difficult to watch even the ones that you did show in the film, but again, necessary for people to know, you know, what was essentially done in their name. Alex Gibney, again, congratulations on the nomination, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Alex Gibney is the director of the film Taxi to the Dark Side, and of course he also made Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. The film opens today at Landmark New Art and Pasadena Playhouse 7 Theaters. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote from Alex's statement as the director, where he said, "The issue of torture is not really about interrogation techniques. It is about a pandemic of corruption that ensues when the rule of law is weakened." That's Alex Gibney's director's statement, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You have been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of this show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Have a wonderful weekend, and thanks for listening.